Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Transitions Tuesday here on Mind Talk. Every Tuesday is the day that we talk about the different ways in which our lives can take different turns, transition to different perspectives and different experiences. And today's guest is certainly no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Karen Casey, who is the author of many, many books. But today we're really going to be discussing codependence and the power of detachment. Dr. Karen Casey is the winner of a Johnson Institute America Honors Recovery Award for her contributions in the field, and she is quite the sought-after speaker at recovery and spirituality conferences throughout the country. Dr. Karen Casey, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to have an opportunity to be with you on this program, Dr. Brewer.
Now, Dr. Casey, you heard me make a bit of an emphasis on the word detachment, because nowadays, you know, we hear a lot about healthy attachment. We don't hear about healthy detachment. So I'm going to start at the very beginning with actually asking you to go into a little bit more detail about the title of your book, Codependence and the Power of Detachment.
Okay, well, thank you for that opportunity, because, you know, I didn't know myself what codependence was for so many years. I had no idea that my dependence on others was what gave really root to my own discomfort in life. And I don't think that that word ever had any meaning whatsoever to most people. I grew up codependent. I know that now. I grew up absolutely needing some affirmation or attention from others in order to feel like I was not invisible. I depended on that completely. And my code, and so when I look at the word codependence, I really see that as a definition for living our lives around the behavior and the actions of others. We are dependent on all of that in order to have any sense of who we are. And of course, in the process, we lose ourselves completely. We don't learn who we are at all. We only know who we are in respect or relation to all of those other people. So we have multiple personalities, really. And so codependence is so insidious because of that reliance always on letting somebody else's mood define who we are. And so when I think of that, and then the power of detachment, being able to detach from the behavior, the moods, the attitudes, the opinions of others, to be able to just let those belong to those people rather than taking on all of their opinions and attitudes as our own, is what detachment is all about. You know, detaching from others and allowing others to be whoever they want to be or need to be in that moment is the only way we will have that's the only way we can honor our own lives. And actually, that's the only way we can honor the lives of others, too. I really think that each of us has a very unique, specific journey, and our lives intersect for what we can learn from each other, but they don't intersect because of what we are supposed to, how we are supposed to control one another. So codependence and detachment literally go hand in hand. You know, the codependence is the illness, the detachment is the healing from that illness.
You talk about your own early experiences of codependence really as a child, because you describe yourself as a child living in constant fear, with daily stomach aches, frequent vomiting. And I'm going to quote you now, you say that you realize now that this was all due to your inability to detach from the scowls or scoldings, real or imagined, you frequently got from your parents. How many children are very much connected to the ways in which their parents respond to them, but for the child who is in a codependent relationship, for the adult in a codependent relationship, it means so much more, I would suspect. What are your thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that the patterns for our lives begin so early. And in my own life, as you refer to in the quote you said, it seemed as though I was constantly watching the faces of others to see who I was, to see if I was okay. And it was a really dysfunctional family. It was a very unhealthy family. So I never, ever got the kind of response from my parents that would assure me that I was really okay, that I was a healthy, lovable child. Everything was very conditional. And so I think that really millions of people grow up in similar situations, which is what turns people to, to seek unhealthy alliances with others, whether it's men or women or alcohol or other drugs. For me, it was, kind of all of those, all of the above. I took my first drink at 13 as a way of quelling that inner pain, that inner sense of never fitting in. And I then chose alliances with boys and then men as a way of trying to fill that empty hole. And I see that empty hole as really the core of codependence. We're trying to attach ourselves to something else that will make us feel whole, and none of those choices will ever make us feel whole. But we are, I'm talking about my story, which was. I'm nearly 77 now, so I spent a lot of years, with that hole. And we are living in a culture right now where this dis-ease is as prevalent as it ever was. There are millions around us all the time that are living very unhealed lives, looking for some solution, and every solution they seek fails them, because I think the final solution that we have to seek is an alliance with a power greater than ourselves, and that ultimately is the only thing that will begin to fill that hole. So, codependence and attachment to others never leads us where we need to go. That's why it is so important for us to learn the power of detachment, the power of letting others be, and know that what we have to do is to develop our own inner strength through our own relationship with a power greater than ourselves. Alcohol didn't work. Pills didn't work. Alliances with men didn't work. None of those choices worked for me, nor will they work for anybody else, nor did they work for any of the people I talked about in this book.
You talk about the power, the almost urgencies of being able to detach from the other in order to really learn and pay attention to yourself and what's really true for you, the individual. And even as you say that, I know there are people who are listening who are feeling a little bit edgy about that. When you've spent so much of your life being so focused on other, it can be really frightening to think that there's number one, that there's another way to be, and number two, that way to be is to really focus on self when self has been so scary for so long.
All that, you really, really brought up such a good point, Dr. Brewer, because, you know, we are really nurtured into being caretakers, particularly as women, but men too in this culture, that we feel as though always doing for others is really such a good thing to do. You know, it's kind, it's helpful. What we don't realize, and what I didn't know for such a long time, was my constant focus on the other people in my life. And I'm reminded of a number of the stories in the book, and the first one that comes to mind is Rose's story, you know, with a big family of 9 kids. Her constant focus on others, she thought, made her a good mother. You know, we think that when we are focusing on others and trying to make their lives easier, we're actually helping them. And, you know, when the family, when people are, when the children are small, obviously we have to be attentive, but we also have to know when it's time to let others have their own journey. We came into this life, my belief is we came into this life because we have particular lessons to learn. And we need to have our own interactions with people so that we can learn those lessons. And when there is a hovering parent, or a hovering spouse, always trying to manage those lessons that we are here to learn, then neither that hovering parent or spouse or the person needing to learn the lesson has an opportunity to fulfill their own destiny in that moment. So, I mean, the whole thing just keeps getting more and more complicated, and the culture tells us we need to be, let's not be selfish. Let's help each other out. Well, there's a difference between I am here to be truly helpful and I am here to take control of your life. And I think that we get those two things very confused. That's a prayer that I say for myself every morning when I get up. And it's from another part of my spiritual journey, The Course in Miracles. And it's a prayer that begins with, I am here only to be truly helpful. I am here to represent him who sent me. That is a very different idea than I am here to take control of your life. I am here to make sure I am okay as a result of you doing what I want you to do. And that's the classic definition of codependence. I am here to make sure you do what I want you to do so I will feel okay.
And of course, if you said the one of the problems with that perspective is that there's never any way for that to really satisfy the needs or the growth of either individual.
That's right. Right. When our attention is that focused on somebody else, and we do that so unconsciously, we just begin to focus on others. We you know, look at every card at the Hallmark store that you pick up. It's always somehow about making each relationship being special in the way that I will take care of you. And so we grow up thinking that that's for sure the kindest, best way for us to be. Well, that isn't necessarily the kindest way for us to be at all. And so I think it is confusing to people. And when people are first introduced to this idea, it feels selfish and like, no, that's, I want to be really attached to those people around me. Well, there's a difference between attachment and healthy detachment. I look at healthy detachment as the true sign of love, because it's allowing everybody the respect to make their own choices.
The concept of spirituality, which you talk about as being yours, you're not trying to change anybody else's view, but there, as you know, there are so many people who will you know, look at AA, look at Al-Anon, look at, you know, various programs that are designed to help people on their journey. And the minute they hear anything having to do with spirituality or a religious or spiritual belief system, they're often running in the opposite direction because it doesn't feel like it's a reasonable good fit. What do you say to those folks?
Pamela, I understand so completely because when I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting in 1974, at the time I was working on my PhD at the University of Minnesota. So I was the typical atheist graduate student. I walked in and I looked at the 12 steps and the 12 traditions on the wall and I thought, oh my God, this will never work for me because of the mention of God. You know, I was one of those proud individuals at that time who thought that God was irrelevant, that didn't even believe in the existence of a God. What I have come to know is that none of these programs are religion specific. None of these programs demand that we believe in a God of any kind. All they say is that our journey will be simpler, our journey will have more meaning if we can allow the idea, just be willing to believe that there might be a power greater than ourselves who can help us traverse this world that we live in. And little by little, I became comfortable with the idea that I didn't have to actually believe in a God. I could believe in the strength of the group to give me the support that I needed. And then eventually that belief just became a belief in a greater power that I did not ever have to define. Now, much later in life, I can comfortably say I do believe in a God. I do believe that we are surrounded by hovering angels that guide our journey. I do believe that we have a lot of help available to us, but I didn't come into the rooms with that belief at all. And so what I say to people who are new to, and I'm still very active, I've never quit going to Al-Anon or AA, and in fact, I will celebrate my 40-year anniversary in AA in just a little over a week, and I've always remained very active in both groups, and I tell newcomers, don't let any part of this scare you off. Just be willing to come and listen and let the wisdom of your elders in these circles show you how you can live a more comfortable life. Because that's finally all it's about. It's to be comfortable in our own skin and to recognize that we have to let others be comfortable in their own skin too and make their own journey a journey that we can watch and appreciate, but we don't ever need to judge or try to control. You know, it's kind of like, if you want help from me, ask and I'll offer you my experience, strength, and hope. But I'm not going to offer you a list of this is what you must do.
The idea that you just articulated, that you were able to begin to believe in the power of the group, is really, I think, an important piece of understanding for folks listening who again, may not be where you are today, may in fact be where you were then. Karen Casey, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear more about the story of Rosa. You mentioned her a few minutes ago. So, folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Transitions Tuesday here on Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Dr. Karen Casey, who is the author of many books, including Codependence and the Power of Detachment, How to Set Boundaries and Make Your Life Your Own. We'll be right back. Dr. Casey, you made reference to Rosa. Tell us a little bit more about Rosa.
Okay. You know, when I interviewed her, this was, you know, later, much later in her journey. And so she was hesitant at first to tell me her story, I think, just because she was an older woman, and she just recently passed on, in fact. But she was very significant in my life for many years because of her recovery. But she talked about, you know, being married to an alcoholic man and didn't have any idea that he was alcoholic when she married him. It didn't take very long for her to realize that he wasn't very present for so much of what she needed him to be present for, because they were, you know, a very good, active Catholic family, and she had one child after another until they numbered 9 children. And she realized, still didn't realize, I guess I would have to say, that he was alcoholic. It was just that he drank a lot and was often drunk in the evenings when she really needed him to help her. And so at church, she saw in the bulletin mention of an Al-Anon meeting. And she didn't know what that meant, but she noticed that announcement in the bulletin many times, and finally she decided to go and explore it. And because they were a rather prominent family in the community, in the neighborhood, and at their particular parish, she was afraid to let anybody know who it was she was married to. And so she sat and listened. She finally, after going week after week, became courageous enough to begin to talk of her own struggles. And the thing that was so amazing, I felt, is that she never, ever ended up with a completely sober husband. But she did, in fact, stay committed to the marriage. She stayed, and that was because she stayed committed to the program of Al-Anon and saw that finally she had to allow him, and then ultimately all of their children too, many of whom all became alcoholic as well. She finally got to the point where she understood that that she had to detach, allowing each of them to make whatever journey they were here to make. And that was a very, very difficult struggle for her, because she was a Catholic woman who had been always told that it was her job to take care of her family, and that if they didn't toe the line, it was a direct reflection of her, and that the same thing was true of her husband, that somehow she felt it was her responsibility to make him toe the line, and that was an impossible task. All 10 of them were impossible tasks for her. But she went to Al-Anon when she finally started to go, she went to Al-Anon literally for the rest of her life. And she knew that the peace that she finally came to experience was because she had been able to just say their journey belongs with them and God, and I am not the God in their life. And, you know, I think that that is what finally has to happen for any of us who are involved in a relationship where we are ensnared by the behavior of others, where we are absolutely controlled, that our own journey has been lost in the process of somebody else's journey, that they have that we've lost all sense of boundaries. We don't even know what that word means. I had no idea what that word meant when I went into Al-Anon. Boundaries, you know, boundaries was a, you know, people had boundaries from one yard to the next, one piece of property to the next. I never had any idea what the word boundary meant when it came to a relationship of of any two people, because to me that was putting up a barrier between the two. I saw boundary as barrier rather than as freedom. But Rose learned about boundary, and she learned it in the positive way, as allowing herself to have the freedom to live her own life. She went through a lot. She went away to a program to learn more about it. She even moved out of the home. Her children were all grown and gone, but she moved out of their home for a while so that she could really just focus on herself. But what she never did was she never left the commitment to really sticking with her husband, though no longer letting him take charge of her life. She didn't take charge of his either. And, he never, ever had any sustained sobriety throughout the entire 60-some years they were married. He was never sober, really. But she was able to be peaceful because she was able to detach from that, because she learned about the boundaries that do the, and boundaries is a healthy idea to just allow us to say, that is your journey and this is mine, and I will appreciate yours and allow you to live it, and I know that in the process I must live my own. And that's why it's so helpful to finally be able to believe in a power greater than ourselves, because that power is what we need, I think, to be able to walk our own journey comfortably, you know, to know that we in fact have purpose in our own life. I think most people most people struggle to think, what is my purpose in this life? And I certainly learned through Al-Anon and AA and my spiritual pathway with A Course in Miracles that my purpose here is to be helpful, not controlling. My purpose here is to be loving, you know, not full of judgment. My purpose here is really to appreciate those others and know that we do have a shared journey, but sharing the journey with somebody else is not the same at all as leading somebody on their journey.
I'd like to go back to almost the beginning of the conversation about Rosa, when you said uh-huh. that she married someone and she had no idea that her husband was an alcoholic. And so many times when people ultimately will say, I had no idea he was an alcoholic or she was an alcoholic, the people around them said, well, how could you not know? And which adds to that individual's, I would suggest, sense of guilt and failure that they didn't know because they should have known, and now it really is their job to fix it. What do you say to that experience?
Well, I think that particularly at the time when she was experiencing this, but even today, you know, we don't necessarily see other people's behavior as a result of their alcohol or drug use. You know, we just, and particularly if we're codependent, we see their behavior as somehow a reflection of how they feel about us. You know, if most people who are alcoholic are functional alcoholics, you know, they go about their lives, they maintain their jobs, they do a lot of what they need to do, and yet they don't interact in a very healthy way with nearly anybody. But much of their alcohol or drug use is hidden or after hours, so to speak. So, you know, I was a high functioning alcoholic. Most people during the time that, and I started drinking at 13 and never really stopped. And by the time I actually came into AA, I was drinking a bottle of booze nearly every day. but I was still a high-functioning alcoholic throughout all that time. I ended up getting a PhD. Most people around me had no idea that alcohol was so important to my life. And I think that's what happened to Rose. Her husband always provided well for the family. He was a CPA. He sold real estate. He was a good provider. You know, they marched off to church every Sunday with nine children and looked like upstanding people in the community. And they were. But they also had this secret. And she didn't recognize that alcohol, and that wasn't unusual, Pamela. People don't recognize that alcohol is really the root of some of the insane behavior until it reaches such extreme outbursts, I guess I would say. They don't see the alcohol as part of it. And so many people keep it hidden, you know, until something tragic really happens. They are really secret drinkers and people don't know. So it's not unusual for people to live in the midst of alcoholic homes or in the midst of alcoholic relationships and not see alcoholism as the direct cause of what is of the problems that are occurring. You know, in my first marriage with Bill, we were both obviously alcoholic, but I was so much more codependent, in the sense that I was constantly watching his behavior and the amount he was drinking. And so, you know, I could point to him as the person who drank so much more than me, and at times he did. But I was, but I never saw alcohol as actually what was destroying our marriage. I felt like the alcohol was making him an unfaithful husband, but I never understood that the amount we were drinking defined us as alcoholic. And I lived in that with him for 12 years. You know, I mean, it's so insidious, and we don't want... I don't want to say we don't want to understand it, but if we name it as what it really is, then it really requires that we do something about it. And that something that we need to do is something for ourselves, because we can't make them, the other person, do anything at all.
You know, I think about...
I don't know if that really...
No, that absolutely makes sense. And I think what you've done is actually to explain to many people a reality that I think that for those folks who are in the mindset of blaming themselves for somebody else's behavior, you really have let them know that it is not at all uncommon that someone else be alcoholic, for example, and the spouse not know. And so really sort of given them some relief from a lot of the self-blame that can also come along with having a family member, whether it's a child, a spouse, or a parent, who is in the throes of some sort of addiction. What I do wonder about, as the individual becomes healthier, as Rosa became more healthy and more aware of herself. I mean, we all know that there are people all over who will still say, how can you be so selfish as to essentially let your husband do what he's doing, or let your child do what he or she is doing? So there are people who are going to push back against this notion that each individual is in fact ultimately responsible for their own behavior. How did Rosa navigate that kind of social pushback, if you will?
Right. Oh, that's such a good point, Pamela. And it is a difficult, it's really difficult to journey through that, because she struggled with even her adult kids who developed problems, and actually, for the most part, all of them got into recovery programs themselves, but they still even pushed back against her. When she left the home and said, I'm not going to, you know, I'm taking a break. And she moved out and into an apartment for a few months. Her adult kids, who were also by this time, for the most part, all of them in recovery from alcoholism themselves, were angry with her for her taking care of herself. And, you know, that is additionally what is so doggone insidious about this disease of alcoholism. But she knew, and she used the strength of her group and her Al-Anon friends and her Al-Anon sponsor. She knew what she had to do to remain, to maintain her own sanity. And she knew that she simply had to detach from their judgments of her. And I think that's finally what everybody who stays committed to Al-Anon comes to know, comes to really embrace, is I am trying to save my own life here. And only if I save my own life am I able to be any kind of a partner to the other person. And the partnership you may have is not going to be the partnership you really had hoped for. But at least you don't have to abandon the marriage, but you cannot abandon yourself. And that's what learning about detachment allows you to do, is to embrace your journey in spite of what those around you may say or the judgments of those around you. We have to detach from those judgments. And Al-Anon or other spiritual programs or other support groups, that's what they do. They give people support for doing what they need to do to save themselves. And that's what she did. And, you know, it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing for herself, and ultimately, because of my getting to know some of those people too who are now adults, I know that they began to see their mother in a much different light, in a very positive light for what she did for herself. But boy, that selfishness that people initially label all of us who are trying to save ourselves, and it's only because they somehow feel abandoned themselves. So, you know, it's a lifelong journey, this journey of detachment, learning what it really means. And it, for some, the codependence remains a lifelong journey because they never, ever are in a position where they are seeking the kind of freedom that Rose sought, and that all of the other people that I talk about in Codependence and the Power of Detachment sought. Every one of these stories, people finally sought the kind of help that gave them freedom. And, you know, if we don't have freedom to live our own life, we're not living at all.
Well, that is certainly...
We're living in the midst of somebody else's journey, which is simply not allowing that person their own journey, and definitely not allowing ourselves to have our own journey.
Dr. Casey, we will take a break, and when we come back, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about Dana's story. Dana, who was addicted to alcohol, street drugs, and prescription drugs. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will be back in just a moment. Thank you. Casey, we are certainly continuing our conversation with the value and the difficulties with setting boundaries and really taking your life into your hands and making it your own. And there are so many things that we allow to get in the way of that. Often because we think we are helping ourselves or sort of anesthetizing ourselves against something that is so painful. With Dana's story, she was drinking, she was doing street drugs, and she was doing prescription drugs. Do you worry at all about folks who are using a significant amount of prescription drugs? Do you think that that leads to other kinds of addictions?
Well, I certainly do. At the time that I interviewed Dana about her life, that was certainly predated the concern that we see registered now in state after state, that drugs that Obama has appointed and his recovery. He's a man with, I think, 25 years in recovery, which is certainly a positive step in the right direction. But the opioid addiction that is rampant in this country is far, far, far greater than it was at the time that Dana got hooked on pain medication, right along with her alcohol addiction and street drugs. When I think about how she was cross-addicted to all three, and knowing, as she told me her story, how she was so mindless about her use of all those, all at the same time, the fact that she survived amazes me now, because every day we're reading about the mixture of alcohol and opioid use, or just the overdose from opioid use all by itself. You know, I mean, it has just escalated. I think that I saw just recently on the news that it has escalated 400 times in this last decade right here in Minnesota, the number of people who have died from opioid addiction. And it's, you know, when I think of the cross addiction, it's frightening to me. And Dana's life was so frightening when she told the story of her journey. I just kind of sat there numb, thinking, how in the world has this woman survived? And here she is now, clean and sober. But her journey, I mean, she was introduced to alcohol inadvertently is the wrong word to use, but she was her father's favorite. And from the time she was little, he would take her with him into the bars. And he, you know, all the men in the bars made this big point of, oh, what a darling girl she was. And she would dance and they would give her dimes and little treats and sips of alcohol. And so for her, the attention that she got from others became so necessary that I think turning to street drugs and alcohol and then painkillers, the painkillers were legitimately prescribed for her, as they are for so many people, because of the level of pain that she lived with, because she ended up with so many health issues in her life. She had lupus, which resulted in her having extreme arthritic pain. So she was prescribed opioids in way early in the days when nobody realized that they were going to, in fact, make one addicted to them. And now we know that opioids have to be used very, very selectively and only for short duration. But at the time she was growing up, she had a standing prescription for as much as she needed. And, you know, I mean, every time I look at the news, every time I read a paper online, or every time I turn on the evening news virtually every day. There is a story about addiction and overdoses. And I shudder to think where this culture is going.
What, given that this is such an everyday occurrence, how do you sort of gather your own resources to continue to do the work that you do when every single day you're hearing about someone who is engaged in self-harming and often suicidal behavior?
Yeah, that's really, thanks for that question, and that's a good question. And, you know, I struggled with my own suicidal behavior throughout my life and even into early recovery. And I think the thing that keeps me going, Pamela, is that, like the prayer I said, I am here only to be truly helpful. I'm not here to change the world, but I am here to try to share my story wherever I can with a person who might be interested, and it might have an impact on helping them to make a detour in their lives. And so I feel called when invited to share what I learned, what I knew to be true for me. And I really think that finally is all we can ever do is to speak our own truth and know that those who are ready to hear someone else's truth and try that truth on for size, that's the only way we can actually, I think, have an impact on somebody else's journey. That's the only healthy way we can have an impact on someone else's journey. And ultimately, each person has to find their own truth. But, you know, I think, frankly, Pamela, I think it's harder today than it was than it was 40 years ago when I got clean and sober. I think it's far harder today. And that is what is doubly frightening to me. I think that people who are involved with street drugs of any kind today, they are stronger, they are more potent. People who are on opioids are able to get them in so many nefarious ways, and they have no idea what they are dealing with or what they are mixing. And it's really a different world today. The drug scene is a different world today than it was 40 years ago. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, when I started my alcohol use. And so I don't know how much of an impact I'm having anymore. All I know is I keep writing books. I keep taking opportunities to share my own story and to try to serve as an example that it is possible to choose a different life. And that the missing link, I think, for people and for all of the people I've ever interviewed and all the people that I meet in AA and Al-Anon rooms even today, the missing link was always that hole within that they were trying to fill up, and a hole that finally is only filled, softened, healed by being willing to believe that there might be a power greater than themselves that can help them walk through anything that is frightening, anything that stands before them, any boulder that they're afraid they're going to stumble over, and that they can believe that that power can help them far better than taking a pill or a drink.
And again, just to repeat something that you said earlier, when you began that journey, for you, it was the power of the group that allowed you to feel that you perhaps could make some positive steps in your own regard. So again, when we talk about a power greater than oneself, you get to define who and what that power is. There's not a prescribed quote-unquote power that you have to adhere to or believe in order to start your own journey of healing.
That's right. And I feel that that was so wise of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous to in fact say God as we understand him, rather than God as the Methodist Church defined him, you know, giving everybody the permission to simply seek that power, however they want to define that power. And, you know, as I shared earlier, when I walked into that first Al-Anon room, I absolutely didn't have any belief in a God. I didn't have any belief in any power. I felt empowered by my own life because I was on an achievement track, and I thought I was doing it all. And only in retrospect did I realize how God was showing up in my life again and again and again, and I never realized it. And I think that when people come into the rooms, all they have to do is let us believe for them, let us believe in a God for them until they're really ready to maybe believe in the possibility that there is a power, and the group can serve as that power for as long as it takes. You know, I really would have to say that when I finally went into AA, May 24th, 1976, I looked at that room of 200 people, and I thought, and everybody seemed happy and good-looking and young. You know, I was 36, and everybody was kind of between the ages of 25 and 45, and people were laughing and hugging, and I thought, my God, this is what I want, you know. And I would have to say that I got sober, really, on the fellowship. I really felt comforted by that group of happy souls. And it's not that everybody is so happy early in recovery, but we all know we're in it together. And that is what was so important for me. That took the place of my believing in God at the very beginning, because I didn't. But I believed that that group had something that I wanted. And that's all that's important, is to look around and say, these people have something that I don't have never had, and I want what they have. And so I'm willing to sit among them and soak it up. And so anybody who feels like they're not a believer, just allow us to show you how our lives have changed. And maybe that will give you the courage to say, I want that too.
For the person who is thinking about what you're saying and thinking about perhaps where their lives have been and encouraged by what you are talking about with respect to the change in your own life, it can be kind of overwhelming. You talked about, you know, non-judgment, and you know, that can be really hard to do, particularly when you think about yourself. I mean, you know, people can strive to be non-judgmental towards others, but it's really hard to be non-judgmental towards yourself. How would you like those individuals who are sort of teetering on the beginning of wanting to get engaged in change, but just feeling overwhelmed by it all, what's a reasonable first step for that person?
Well, I guess I would say that the reasonable first step is just to become willing to say there might be a different way, to see what stands before me. There might be a different way to do my life. Just become willing to say simply that there might be a different way. And that idea then has grown in importance to me throughout my life in all relationships. You know, when I'm in a moment of conflict with somebody, for me to say, gee, there might be a different way to see this, can allow me to detach and step away. But for that person who is just fresh and new, like you're saying, and not sure that they really can go forward, that first little step is simply to say, or to acknowledge, my life isn't working very well. Might there be a different way to do it? And to not make any commitment even to change to begin with, but be among, sit among those folks who have begun making changes, and let their example serve as the inspiration for him or her to just be willing, just willing to make a change too.
Doctor,
it's not about doing anything full force all at once, but truly, when you said just that little step, just say, I'm going to sit among these people, I'm going to go where they are and watch, observe. That's all.
Dr. Karen Casey, thank you so much. Our time has flown by. I would like to just let the listeners know that you do have a website. It is women's, plural, W-O-M-E-N-S, -spirituality.com. Dr. Karen Casey, author of, among many books, Codependence and the Power of Detachment. Thank you so very much for joining us today on Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed my time with you.
Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand by going to myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, just shoot me an email, pamela@mindtalk.org. That's P-A-M-E-L-A at myndtalk.org. Or you can give me a call at 301-654-5286. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. Take care.